Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly, episode 70, recorded on May 30th of 2019, the Photo Geekery show, where we take the geekiest, the most technical topics in the photographic news cycle on a weekly basis, distill that down into something interesting for all of the listeners. That is you listening to this to enjoy. I'm the host, Don Komarechka, and joined with me today is another longtime co-host. He's been on a number of times. I've been trying hard to get him on again lately, but he rejected me numerous times. Totally not his fault. Schedules didn't line up properly. But Mike Howard from the JPEG to RAW podcast is back with us today. Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing great, and I feel really bad about turning you down those two times, and glad you invited me back again.
Well, no, I completely understand. Yeah, I'll often, people don't really see this when they're just listening to the show that comes out on an almost weekly basis. But sometimes it's like 5 or 6 days goes by after I've published something, and I realize I don't even have a guest host lined up for this next episode. And so then I scramble. I'll often find somebody. It works out in the end, but life is busy. I get it. I mean, Mike, you do more than photography. You are an IT professional. You're a father, and so many other things in life basically take charge and take over when it comes to priorities, right?
Yeah, for me, photography is a hobby. I don't want it to become a business. I want it to become a hobby where I can, you know, can enjoy it and not feel pressured and that kind of stuff. So that's for me. My day job is IT, but mainly accounting. So I'm an accountant, also in charge of IT. So yeah, that keeps me pretty busy. And I can't, you said number 70. So this is show number 70. I can't believe you already get number 70.
I know, time flies.
That is incredible.
I'd be closer to 80 if I actually did this every week, as the namesake implies. But I do miss some here and there around the holidays or when I'm off at conferences or what have you. But you know, it's funny because I'm coming up about a month away from my corporate year end, and I'm going to be gathering all of my documents and sending them off to my accountants and what have you. And there's always curiosities from the accountant's perspective. It's like, okay, Don, how the heck is this a business expense? All of the weird rabbit holes that I end up going down. Like recently, I discovered that fluorescein, which is a biologically inert fluorescent dye that you can, like, it's in dye packs for tracers. It's in the little tabs that you put in your eye if you want to see if your cornea scratched or you're being fitted for contact lenses. That fluoresces a yellowish green color, and apparently it doesn't harm biology like plants and what have you. So I'm going to make some flowers glow. Cool. And I'm going to see what the results are. Initial tests are kind of promising, but there'll be a line item on my business expenses somewhere under research and development or whatever title they put it under for these strips that are designed for, you know, optical use, like actual eyeball use. Oh, it's always fun explaining those to the accountants.
Well, hopefully if you use the same people over and over again, they kind of get used to you and know what to ask and know what's normal.
Exactly.
Make the process a little better.
Well, I mean, sometimes it's just some unusual minerals that may or may not fluoresce, and I'm taking a stab in the dark because some of them do, and the ones that I buy don't. It's like, okay, well, now I've got this rock that I might be able to use for my macro photography students when I do workshops. It's kind of fun when you can juxtapose inorganic and organic natural stuff, like crazy crystal formations with beautiful flowers growing around them. And there's always a way to make those, even the failed purchases, turn into something useful.
Sure.
But, Mike, what's new with you? I mean, photography is a hobby of yours, but I know that it is a strong one, and you've got your podcast that's still going, right?
It is still going. We had one this week. We missed a few more weeks than you, so we've been a little bit erratic right now because of my day job and the other part of my life has gotten a little busy right now. The podcast is still going on, all that's still going on, and we want to continue it. And hopefully I can continue it to the day that I retire, when then I can do more with it and have more fun with my
I would still love to do more with this podcast and bring back the Inside the Lens podcast. If anybody remembered those deep dives into a specific topic with an expert in that particular field, it kind of keeps me awake at night knowing that I've kind of neglected that, but there's only so much time in each day. And actually, one of the things that's taking up a lot of time right now And I've mentioned it briefly on some previous episodes, but I am working on a 352-page macro photography book. And it is, by the time people are listening to this, that campaign will be live. As soon as we're done recording, I'm flipping the switch on Kickstarter. And I need everybody's support for this, because in order to fund the production run of a book of this magnitude, it's going to cost me probably more than $30,000 Canadian. But that's what I've set the funding goal to. So if I hit that, I can always contribute a little bit of my own funds if needed. And that's for the bare bones. You know, it doesn't make sense to print anything less than 1,000 copies when you're doing a press run. And that's for the bare bones press run of that. But if I can get enough people support, and when I did Sky Crystals, my snowflake book, I think through, I used Indiegogo at the time, through that campaign, I raised $25,000, and that was 6 or 7 years ago. So it's not a far stretch to think I can get to 30, with a larger audience today and a wider topic, of course, macro photography in general. This is water droplets and insects, flowers, ultraviolet photography, heck, even 3D photography, because why not? I've got 350 pages to fill. Most of it will be completely relevant to everybody. But towards the back, that's when people go down the rabbit holes and just try to, you know, the complete unknowns and just have some fun experimenting and exploring. So that is the project that I've been working very hard on. And by the time you're listening, I want everybody to, if you go to PhotoGeek Weekly or doncom.ca, any of my websites, you will see a link to this campaign. Even if you can't contribute a whole lot, the ebook's going to be $22 Canadian, and the early bird pricing starts at $38. Final pricing at $48 Canadian for a hardcover copy of the book. Now, that's pretty reasonable considering the Canadian dollar is in the toilet right now compared to the US dollar. So you'd be looking at, I don't know, 30 something dollars to get a copy of this 9x9-inch hardcover, awesome book. And, you know, support me, support this project, and it'll be worth it in the end, I'm sure.
Well, I will be checking right after this hopefully be one of your first.
Oh, that'd be great. And, yeah, you get a couple of dollars off there because of it.
Yeah, and your macro photography is what attracted, you know, made me reach out to you from the beginning to have you come on our show and talk about your macro photography. And you know, you are the second, I have to say that, you are the second most viewed of all of our shows.
I am the most viewed that does not involve scantily clad
women.
That's
true, because I will say number one was a boudoir show. Number two was you.
Well, you'll have to have me back on.
It was a tasteful boudoir.
Well, yeah, of course, of course. I wouldn't put that past you. But let's get into the topics of the day, because there's some really interesting ones here. One of them is kind of tangentially related to photography, but it came across my radar because it was a story on Petapixel. And the title is Apple's first 8-core MacBook Pro runs Photoshop up to 75% faster. That's a shocking headline. I mean, that's going to turn heads right there, because of the previous generation of products, you're now claiming, just in a reiterative new release, that your flagship product is 75% faster than the previous ones. Holy cow, that's a statement, right?
Yes. I'm skeptical.
Well, of course, because I know that I keep my finger on the pulse of both the photography industry and the technology, the computer industry, as I'm sure you do to some degree as well, Mike. And I know that those kinds of leaps and bounds just don't happen on a hardware level. So you look into the specifics, and if you dig around a little bit, you can find the actual products that that Apple is putting into their new MacBook Pros, because they don't actually list what they are. But the new 9th generation Intel Core mobile processors include 2 8-core variants, the Core i9-9880H and the Core i9-9980HK. Their marketing team needs some help with these numbers. But the first one is a base clock of 2.3. The extended one is a base clock of 2.4. gigahertz, and that's all we really need to know. We don't really care about what the boost boost single core speeds are at the moment, because these numbers that that are coming out from Apple basically are, if you read the fine print, faster processing of well threaded filters. Right. Now, I have been known to complain about the well-threadedness of Adobe products in the past, specifically Photoshop, because it is horrendously poorly threaded. Yes, some filters are. Like, I don't know if the Liquify filter is yet, but I know that the filter that you can remove motion blur from images, I forget what that one's called, that one's heavily threaded too. There's a handful of them, and this would be an advantage within that. But if you're not sitting there watching progress bars scroll across your screen for an extended period of time, this number means absolutely nothing to you, because that's the only advantage where this would come in. It's not saying that the overall functionality, the, you know, using the tools, and it's specifically for filters and specifically for well threaded filters. Mm-hmm. Even the focus stacking subsystem within Photoshop is very poorly threaded. It might use 4 cores when I look at my CPU usage when I'm running a focus stacking, the auto blend mode in Photoshop, and nothing more than that. So you got 8 cores, you got 16 threads. It's not going to use any of that.
There's so many products that are like that, that there's still, maybe some of them are single core, single threaded. Some of them are, like you said, four threads. There's so many that are so far behind. Now, I think Liquify does not use the GPU.
Liquify uses the GPU. Yeah. So that's another subsystem as well. There, if you upgrade that system, then you're good to go.
Yeah. We talk about threads and so far behind or even further behind on the GPU. But yeah, so it's going to be a very specific task. If you're doing one of those, you'll have the benefit. If you're not, most of your time, you're not going to be getting that 75% improvement. I don't know what the megahertz or gigahertz change is from this to the previous one. So, in things that are not as multi-threaded, it's going to be more dependent upon the gigahertz, the speed of the chip. So if you got a boost in the speed of the chip, you may get something there.
Right. And there's a very minor boost on the base clock. But where it becomes more useful is, as I mentioned, we'd get to it, the Intel Turbo Boost technology, 2.0 maximum single core turbo frequency in gigahertz. And so this is the number that is probably more meaningful to people using the everyday Photoshop stuff, the filters, or even saving files. If you're saving a TIFF file using zip compression, then it might take you a long time if you've got a fairly large file. And that's only a single thread. And so the faster the memory, the processor, and any other related subsystems around a single core, the better it's going to be. So the lower end 8-core is a boost of 4.8 gigahertz. And the higher end, a boost of 5.0. So that difference, I think, would be more meaningful. Mm-hmm. And if you're talking apples to apples, that's what I would really be betting my dollar on, is that single core performance. And the multi-core, yeah, it's there. But the multi-core performance on this chip is less than half the frequency of the single core boost that it could do for, I'm assuming, a brief period of time before thermal limiters would kick in and stop that down a little bit.
And we are talking about a laptop here. If you travel and you need to use a laptop, I mean, you have to do that. It generally, though, if you can, a desktop is going to be more powerful.
Yeah, of course. And, on a desktop market right now, there's been some moving and shaking. And, I've used a desktop computer. I build my own machines, and I'm always contemplating when the next computer is going to, like, when the next foundational components are going to be on the market for me to say, okay, now is it worthy of that upgrade time? And I've been traditionally an Intel, fan over the years. They've just made quality products, and they've been a little bit more expensive, but the performance has always been there. But with all of these speculative execution bugs, or let's call them exploits, that have come up over the last little while, if anybody's heard of Spectre and Meltdown, mm-hmm. and there's been a lot since then, they just seem to keep on coming. Exactly. And multiple variants of every single one. Basically, the hyper-threaded technology on Intel CPUs, you're almost better off at this point in the game, especially if there's been so many and there is still more, to just turn that feature off. And that really hurts the performance. You knock that down quite significantly compared to what AMD is doing, where their multi-threading system for their multiple cores seems to be largely unaffected by at least the latest discoveries within these exploits. And AMD just announced their Ryzen 3000 CPUs, So if you are looking to buy a new system, their 3900X is a 12-core system that has a base frequency of 3.8 and a boost of 4.6. That's pretty good. You're getting a ton of performance out of that. And what I like to see, and I didn't actually expect this, is the performance, especially at the boost frequency, is actually a little bit higher on the 12 core than it is on the 8s and the 6s. It's kind of nice to see that you're not sacrificing a lot by having more cores in terms of the single core performance that, like we said, is still so very important for a lot of software, including Photoshop, Lightroom, and a ton of other creative applications that we're going to be using on a daily basis.
Yeah, and not only that, these prices on these chips are insanely well priced. The top of the line, the Ryzen 9 3900X, is going for right under $500.
That's very nice. Yeah, you have to buy the motherboard, the memory, everything else to go around This is just the CPU. But if this was Intel with a product of that specifications, you'd almost have to double the price.
Well, I think the competing chip is right around $1,100.
Yeah.
From Intel.
So this is new ground. And of course, these ones support PCI Express 4.0, which doubles the throughput on that front, even though there's no hardware that supports it yet. You kind of future-proof what your next upgrade is going to be. And there's rumors right now that at E3, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, that AMD might announce a special limited edition or special edition version that hits a boost frequency of up to 5 gigahertz as well, which will compete even more head-on with Intel. You know, they'll do this by specifically choosing the cream of the crop chips, very selective binning, and only the chips that of the current generation that could handle that. They'll do a limited release of those just to say, hey, we're king of the castle now. And they charge significantly more for that. But that's the law of diminishing returns with any technology, including camera gear.
Yeah. And I think PCI Express 5 is right around the corner. 4 took a little long for them to develop. And I think 5 is right around the corner, which will double 4.
Right.
And you're thinking, why do I care about that speed? I'm not a gamer. Maybe you are a gamer. If you're a gamer, you know, the faster video cards that'll come with this eventually will be hugely beneficial. But if you're not, you know, things like your SSD speeds.
All of your storage is pretty much connected through this now.
Yes. Right?
All of your really fast storage, anyhow.
If you think about it, everything in your system, it runs as fast as the slowest thing in many cases.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're moving around files and stuff like that, those bigger files, taking them off the card or whatever, once you get them in the computer, so USB is another thing, but once you get them in the computer, those speeds of your SSD are limited to some degree by, you know, on the PCI Express lane, if you have it saturated. So having more of that bandwidth there is just going to be more beneficial for us down the road.
Right. And I expect Intel to kind of leapfrog PCI Express 4 and go right to 5, because that means that they would supersede what AMD is doing. It's always a cat and mouse game here.
It is.
And so you jump in wherever you'd like to. So long as it's a new platform, I think, then you're in the right place. Right, something where you've got the option to buy the best CPU available for it now, and maybe there's a better processor later, and you don't have to upgrade the motherboard or any other components.
You mentioned you've always been an Intel person, and I've been just the opposite. I've always been an AMD person, even Cyrex or whatever it was before that. So since the late '80s, I was building my own computer. So every computer in this house is AMD. So if you're worried about is AMD quality there? Is it going to work? My first Intel one is actually the one I'm on now, which is a decent computer. You know, I'm happy with it, but I've been happy for years with AMD, and it's a solid product. I've never had issues with them. They're a little bit cheaper, and up until lately, their performance has been a little bit under Intel. But I think they have caught up, and maybe in some ways, you know, even exceeded. Donna just rebuilt my server and put a Threadripper 16 core, 32 thread CPU into that server. You know, why do you need that, Mike, for a file server? Well, it's also my virtualized server too, so it does virtualization there too.
Right, and heck, you know, you can run encoding software on that, right? Like if you're running Adobe Premiere, it could use either the GPU or the CPU or probably some combination of both. I'm not a huge expert there, but there's a lot of applications that whatever computer resources you have available, it'll just eat it all up. I love when things are N core optimized. No matter how many cores you have, it'll just divide up the workload amongst them all. And away you go. Now, that's not every workload, as we just discussed. Photoshop and a lot of Adobe software, they don't really handle things as well as I'd like when you throw that much on it. And I, when I built my system, I have two 12-core CPUs from Intel. And this is like 6 years ago now that I built it. And these are Xeon CPUs. So there's two of them in here. So I've got 24 cores. Nothing has utilized them at all, aside from a few little pieces of novelty software or folding at home, I should say. You know, if I'm crunching, you know, molecular simulations of protein folding for Stanford University to try and cure cancer, well, that always runs in the background. So if you actually, if you check out photogeekweekly.com, there's a little tally chart on the side, a little roster of who is folding for our team PGW. So if you're curious about what that's all about and you want your processing cycles to be used when you're asleep, then go and check that out too. But beyond that, you know, it's always, okay, do we lust after the latest new camera? Absolutely. Well, probably we do. And and so we do that with every bit of technology that we have, our computers and our, you know, even displays. I mean, I just love the beautiful 30-inch 4K display that I use for my main editing. But whenever there's a new display announcement, I raise an eyebrow. It's like, okay, well, how is this one better than the one that I already have? Can I justify that upgrade? And oftentimes I, you know, for things like a display, I don't change them very frequently. And things like a computer, I kind of stick to my guns for as long as I possibly can. But if you are looking to upgrade, just know that the numbers that are often promoted by Apple or Adobe or any big organization in terms of performance gains, take them with a very big grain of salt.
Absolutely.
Talking about performance gains, well, it's not exactly performance, but this kind of came across my radar again this week, and it was interesting. And another eyebrow-raising bit of skepticism on F-Stoppers, this article called "Dot Photon Raw Makes Raw Quality with JPEG File Size a Reality." Okay, well, Mr. JPEG to Raw, this is kind of fitting to have you on the show to discuss this type of stuff. So I don't know if you had a chance to dig into the article. The software is only available right now for Mac OS, so neither of us have really had the ability to play with it, right?
Right. And I think they're doing it specific for a specific camera. So this is not available for every camera. Like my camera, this compression is not available for my camera. I think for like the Nikon, I'm a Nikon cheater. So for Nikon, where's that list? It's only
they've got the D5, D810, and D850 currently available.
So I shoot with a D500. And you know, that's not available. Or if you're a D750 shooter, or if you're one of the new mirrorless shooters, it's not going to be there. There's a number of Sonys and Canons out there that does it. Now, they say, the article says, in a world of true lossless raw compression. But the from my reading of it, it does sound like they are. It is not lossless.
This kind of reminds me of. Do you remember the software? It's probably still available. JPEG Mini, where it would just run its own specialized kind of optimization algorithm on JPEGs, where it would create a smaller file size and it would tell you by percentage how much smaller it is. And unless you really, really look or do a direct comparison overlapping the two, you probably couldn't tell much of a difference, but you'd get a gain in terms of that. Now, the article here, written by Quentin Decalé, I'm not sure how I pronounce that because it's French.
You're better than me.
But the article kind of reads as a sales pitch, and that bothers me because it doesn't state anywhere that it's specifically sponsored. So if I read one of the questions here, it's a headline question. Is it truly lossless? And the answer is, now let's answer the question that you should be asking. Is there truly no loss of quality with this compression system? Well, it seems like it. No.
Seems like
it. No. That okay. Number one, you're not answering the question. And number two, the question that you are answering that I didn't even ask, you're not giving a concrete answer to. Red flags and alarms are going off in my head here. So what the heck is going on? They claim that there is a significant reduction in file size. So for an NEF file from a D810, which would normally take around 40 megabytes on the hard drive. The image that is compressed through .photon RAW is only around 12 megabytes. Now, okay, let's take a step back and understand what lossless compression is, Mike. I mean, all of our cameras do this when we shoot a RAW file, because every RAW file out of our camera is going to be a slightly different file size, right? They're not all consistent because they're
different data.
Compressing. Yeah. Well, it's different data, and they are running some fairly quick compression algorithm on that information. Not sure exactly what it is, but if you open up Photoshop and you you're saving a TIFF file, you can choose no compression. You can choose LZW and zip. And if you choose LZW, that's the kind of compression that I believe GIF animations and GIF files will use, or GIF, however you want to say it. And it's older, it's really fast, but the amount of compression is not huge. Zip files, which use the deflate algorithm, is much more prominent, much more effective at compressing information, but it takes a lot more time. So I would suspect when you're saving a file from, or when you're actually pressing the shutter button on your camera, rather, that when it's compressing the information, it's not going to do a really heavy compression because that's so processor intensive. Even if it could save space on the memory card, it would be slowing the entire thing down. So there's compromises that have to be made there, right?
Yep. And, you know, for me, I don't have to worry about storage. I got tons of storage. If you do worry about storage, you know, you may be interested in, you know, is the loss of quality. Because I think if you're going from that massive of a drop in file size, you have to be throwing away some real data.
Oh, that's what I'm getting to. Because if you switch, I wanted you to interject. Because if you switch the algorithm to the deflate algorithm or to LZMA, which is another even more aggressive algorithm, then these will give you smaller files. Yeah. And it would be nice if you could say after the fact, once you get the files on your computer, you want to compress these images a little bit more just to save a bit more space, but do it in a lossless way, then that'd be great. And maybe there should be a program out there that does this, but the gains are not going to be anywhere near as substantive as 40 megabytes down to 12 megabytes. If that's the case, you are definitely throwing information away.
You have to be. I mean, that's like JPEG size. And we know JPEGs are throwing away information. That's why we shoot RAW.
Well, exactly, and they're rolling
processing the image,
right? Yeah, they're rolling this information into DNG files. So, I mean, there's some format standardization within that, but you can convert a JPEG to a DNG file, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, DNG can be the host of pretty much any file format, and so I think that might be something very similar to what they're doing here in order to accomplish this. They didn't test things that would be a surefire test. And I kind of wanted to try this. If I were to take a RAW file that I had photographed with a white balance that was completely out of whack and run it through this program and then try to change the white balance afterwards, I'd probably get nothing because it is not any more RAW data. As soon as you process a RAW file in any way, when you convert it to a TIFF or any other file format, when you run it through an external plugin in Lightroom or whatever your RAW processor is, it ceases to be RAW data. It has been demosaicked into pixel information where each dot has RGB values, whereas a RAW value, every photo set on the sensor is either red, green, or blue, not and. And as soon as that process happens, you lose a lot of the functionality that you would have with RAW processing. And so they are processing this. They have to be. There's no question about it. And while the quality on the other end is good, at least from what I can tell with the, you know, this article, and it, again, it does kind of read like an ad, I don't think I'd be sacrificing things. I think that I would kind of leave well enough alone.
Yeah, for me, I shoot RAW because I want the RAW, and I don't want some JPEG size file that has been compressed like that. And maybe it's not having all the JPEG processing that has gone on there, but it has to have some processing. Now, I wanted to ask you a question because this guy or this person who did this article said that they took an original image and then the processed image through their, you know, this compression thing, took them into Photoshop and then used the layer blending mode
the,
called
the difference blending mode, yeah,
and said there was nothing there. Is that a true way? That seems no. I'm not technical, but that doesn't seem like a way that would really prove that.
No, it wouldn't, because you're in Photoshop at this point. So both of the images have been demosaiced, and you're comparing non-raw data to non-raw data. So it's, you want to compare apples to apples, but you're comparing oranges to limes at this point. Mm-hmm. And so it, yes, sure. They're both citrus. Thank you for sharing that to me. But it doesn't really tell me anything of use.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, look, as file sizes get larger and larger because our cameras have more and more megapixels, you know, even me at some point who has a massive amount of storage here at my house may one day go, wow, wish I could save some space.
But, okay, here's the thing. This software costs you $49 a year. Now, if compressing all of your data so that it fits in your existing hard drives on a yearly basis, say it would save you from buying a new hard drive for 3 years.
Yeah.
Well, in 3 years from now, $150 will probably get you a ton of extra hard drive space, right? Well,
10 terabyte right now is right around a little over $200 here US.
So in 3 years, it would probably be below the $150 price point.
And a 10 terabyte drive can hold quite a few photos.
Exactly. And so, you know, they do make the argument here as well, that they are in the DNG format, that there's no obsolescence, that the DNG format has been around since 2014, where Canon, or sorry, 2004, where Canon over the same time frame has switched from the .CRW to the .CR2 and now the .CR3 format, and everybody is constantly changing their raw information. Well, you know, I evaluated that at the very beginning to think, well, you know, when I'm importing into Lightroom, at the time, this was probably the first version of Lightroom, I played with converting to DNG files because, okay, well, wouldn't that be nice to have a format that will survive into antiquity? You know, 50 years from now, these files will still be read. But every single RAW file format that has ever been created is still currently supported. And there, I can't perceive a reason why any of the big software manufacturers would stop supporting formats that they have previously supported, because who knows when people are going to go back through their archives and the internet would go up in arms over something like that, right?
Yeah, and plus, if you ever use I'm Nikon. If you ever use some of Nikon software, they don't have DNG support, some of the software there. So you may be locked into, okay, that's great. That's still supported. The DNG is still supported, but I got to use specific software with it. Not all software recognizes that. For me, if I debated with it too. Should I go DNG? I think all of these things, even DNG, you say it would be around in 50 years from now. We don't know. It may not.
You know, right. And let's play devil's advocate here. Let's say that it is around in 50 years, but my existing RAW file format, whatever you happen to be shooting, is not. Well, Adobe has always offered their DNG converter for free. And so even if Adobe is no longer supporting that, the current versions that will convert things to DNG exist right now. And if it's free on the internet right now, it will be forever available from somebody. So you're not going to be stuck between a rock and a hard place in any case. So if you do need to convert to DNG at some point, 50 years from now, do it then.
Yeah. That's my thought. I'm going to stick with Nikon NIFS files. I think that if we ever get to the point where they're not supported anymore, there will be some kind of, you know, conversion process that you can do at that point.
And, you know, again, the article basically says what I liked, and he's got a bunch of lists, and then he says what could be improved. Not what I don't like, not what I hated. It's what is on the future track for this company to produce within the next year as the con list. And and so that makes it feel so much like it's an advertisement, and it's not being declared as such. And if you read the comments on this, there are so many people that are complaining that somebody signed up to make a post on this website just to say how much they love the software and have never posted ever before. So, I don't want to read too much into that. I don't know the stories of anybody behind that, but it does look a little sketchy to me. But hey, if you want to see what this technology is all about, because Mike and I do not have access to a Mac to run it and see exactly what things are, I'd be very curious to see What happens for things like white balance control on a converted image? Because I have a very strong suspicion that that is baked in as soon as you run the image through the software. And that's one of the reasons why I love having raw data.
Yep. Now, we'll say, so one thing I would add, so it's, I mentioned how I've got tons of storage space here. I've got almost 70 terabyte of storage here. But I do back up my photos to the cloud. Yeah. So I have two copies here and one I back up to the cloud. So yes, I would love for smaller files that would be able to upload to the cloud. And that would help me save there. And if you're on a bandwidth restricted, you know, your ISP restricts your bandwidth, data usage, or whatever, that may be critical there for you too. But for me personally, I shoot raw because I want all that raw stuff. And I might be interested in lossless compression. It's going to give me a little bit of compression, but I'm not willing to take that kind of compression to talk about and potentially lose some, you know, some data there. Even if I think for me, even if I couldn't see it when I looked at it, even if it was so good that Mike's eyes, because I'm not nearly as good at this as you, Don, Mike's eyes couldn't see it, I would know it was there and I still wouldn't want to do it, because maybe someday I will get better and I will be able to, I'll be ticked off that I've got all these files that are compressed and I've got, you know, I can't do anything about it now.
Especially considering that raw processors are constantly getting better and better. Yeah. And if you were to take a raw image that you took 10 years ago and process it through software that is a decade old versus process it through today's software, there'd be a marked improvement on mm-hmm. what you could get out of that file. To throw away that potential future-proofing benefit of being able to look back on your images and eke out that extra little, you know, 5%, if that's all it's worth, I've got images from years ago that I haven't touched yet. And yeah, shame on me. But we all shoot too much and we let a lot of stuff sit and then we move on to the next thing. It's just kind of the par for the course, I think, at this point in the game. And I've got my Lightroom catalog. I'm switched over to On1 now. But the last time I had looked at the totals in Lightroom was something like 700,000 images. And So... 300 or 400 images might result in one snowflake photograph, right? Mm-hmm. And I've published hundreds of those, so you can see how those numbers add up. But I would still never want to throw away any of the raw images from any of it. If I run out of space, I buy another hard drive. I've got a hard drive. I've got a NAS array right here that has three empty drive bays in it. All I have to do is pop in a new drive, heal things up, and away I go. I've got more space.
Do you know what? One of the things that upsets me is there's a set of images back from when I first got into photography that are some of the ones that happened to be around time when my kids were small. Some of the ones I really love the most. And for whatever stupid reason, back in that day, I didn't shoot RAW. I was shooting JPEG. And all I have of some of those images is an 800 by 600 or whatever those dimensions are, about that, 800 by 600, that I somehow edited and saved just that. And that's all I got. And I kick myself every time I look at it and go, what a fool.
Run that through On1 Perfect Resize or whatever the Photoshop upscaling stuff is. Maybe you could get a little bit more, but you're still not going to make anything more than a 5x7 or 8x10 exactly. print at the most.
Yeah, it is. Ah, well. So it's, you know, things like that. You never know what somewhere down the road, what image you're going to want to go back to.
Exactly. And to have them all there for us, I think we should avoid software like .Photon RAW, especially when I'm not getting complete transparency with what they're up to there. All right, let's go on to the next story. Sure. This one is, it's kind of a fun one, but it's also, I don't want to say controversial, but opinionated, I think is a better word. On DP Review, but I've seen it everywhere, Lomography announces a Petzval 55mm f1.7 lens for full frame mirrorless cameras. And so Lomography, if you're unfamiliar with the brand, they do a lot of fun film stuff, fun, digital lenses, of course, but they're purely mechanical. They'll just mount on a digital body. And this is a 55 millimeter, a fairly wide aperture of 1.7. And if you've not seen these lenses, they look pretty.
They do.
Especially the brass ones. I mean, there's two types in brass, one in aluminum, but the just the unpainted brass lenses, they just look gorgeous, but that might just be the hipster in me coming out. because I mean, I kind of love the aesthetics of certain things. And if it was, you know, functional, if it served a particular purpose and it had that look, I'd be all over it. But these lenses are based on fairly old lens design. In fact, the Petzval lens was basically, in optical terms, it was two doublets with an aperture in between. And so the aperture, you could put in a waterhouse aperture that would have different sizes or shapes. And as they have, you could get all sorts of novelty shapes inside here. So if you put in an aperture that's shaped like a starburst, well, then all of your bokeh in the background becomes a starburst or a heart or a snowflake. They actually have a snowflake one. And I bought into one of their earlier lenses, a daguerreotype. I think it was a 64 millimeter lens. And just as beautiful as this. The optical quality is subpar at best, but you're not buying a lens like this for the optical quality. You're buying it for the quirkiness and the character. It's also the reason why I've bought a Trioplan 100 from Meyer Optic, because it has a soap bubble bokeh. This lens, they are touting it as having a swirly bokeh, where the out of focus background elements kind of have a swirl effect to it, mm-hmm. right out of camera, which could be interesting for creativity. It's so easily overdone. It would be like having a fisheye lens on your camera all day, in the sense that that effect is good for maybe one shot. But if you overuse it, you're just going to nauseate your audience.
Absolutely.
But even still, I mean, even just reading the write-up, not sure if you looked at the video or anything, lenses like this have any appeal to you, Mike?
To me, no. I'm more on the modern lenses that have good autofocus and, you know, stuff like that. So no, you know, because it mainly because of what I shoot. I shoot sports and wildlife, and this lens,
this is not a lens for that.
No, this is not a lens for that. And I'm trying to get more into landscape, but you know, this lens, it looks cool. Like you said, the brass one looks really nice. So that would look, just the look of it is
if
so
you
cool.
had somebody like if you had Nikon or even Sigma, like any of the larger manufacturers make, Sigma makes its art series lenses. Okay, take that art theme to the next level and make an art lens that is just beautiful brass design, but inside is the latest and greatest autofocus and optics and everything else. I mean, I would buy that.
I would too.
Too. Of course, Leica does some silver lenses and stuff like that, but they're still mostly mechanical and not the the everyday daily driver lens that we would want to have on our camera.
Because there's so many lenses I still want for stuff, I have not spent the money yet on some of these, vintage lenses and some of those. I know a lot of people who do. And, you know, love having all these different vintage lenses they can try out. And you can get some pretty good deals on some of those, that, you know, true vintage ones.
And I bought an old Minolta lens recently that I'm going to have to adapt with some bicycle inner tube.
What?
to basically turn it into a makeshift tilt shift lens. So
that sounds like
the lens cost me, I think, $30, and the extra components will probably not top into the double digits. So I've always wanted a tilt shift lens, but I've never wanted to actually spend the ridiculous amount of money on one. So we'll see how that experiment goes. I expect multiple levels of failure before any degree of success, but that's part of what I enjoy about it.
Yeah, and the people I know who love finding those deals and finding a good vintage lens to try out. Maybe I should probably do that at some point. But there's just so many things on my list that I want to buy. I haven't got to that point yet.
Well, and especially when it comes to price, right? So this lens, if you wanted to have the beautiful satin finished brass one, it's $450. Mm-hmm. If you want a brass painted black with the brass details coming through for lettering, they'll charge you $50 more for that. I wouldn't want that one. But if you want just black anodized aluminum, you come in at a $399 price point. Now, these prices are, I mean, they're nothing to, they're not compared to like a $1,000, $2,000 modern lens that has all the bells and whistles. But at the core of it, it's funny, if you look at the very back of the lens, I'm not sure if you saw this, but where's that image here? It says on the ring where you'd normally find a serial number where the lens mount is on the back.
Yeah.
It says handcrafted in central China. That's okay. handcrafted in central Germany, maybe central China. That just that's trying too hard.
I wonder what part of it was handcrafted in central China.
Yes. Well, I mean, it was maybe all assembled, machined in a factory and assembled there, but, okay. It's fun.
Yeah.
If you're into the hipster lenses, then that's great. I own a lens very similar to this, and it did come with some of these aperture insets, and I used it a handful of times, and now it kind of sits looking very pretty on a shelf in a display case in my studio. There could be some interesting techniques. In the comments, somebody is saying that they'd love to experiment with astroscapes. Could you imagine an out of focus star field that has a swirl to it?
But yeah, that could be a cool effect.
But then what if you have that as a star trail image where you've got the swirl from the lens in one direction, but the swirl from the planet's rotation in an opposite direction? You could create some weird maelstrom in the sky, so the ideas start spinning in my head. It's like, well, maybe could justify the purchase of this. No, I've too much already. It's that gear acquisition syndrome coming up.
I would love to see, if anybody did own one, I would love to see some images from it. Some true images, not these ones they have posted there, which are fine images.
Right. And they are going to be releasing this in the Sony E mount, the Canon RF, and the Nikon Z mounts. Unfortunately, not the L mount, which is the mount for full frame cameras that I am currently using with my Panasonic S1R. And of course, Leica has cameras in that field, and Sigma will come out with some of their Foveon within that. So they missed the boat on having me buy one of these by not offering it in an L mount, but maybe that will come in the future.
Because and I am still F mount. I'm still the DSLR.
Oh, well, they got these funky hipster lenses for the F mount too. You're not left behind. You just don't need this one. There's no, others for you. which again, I know it's not your cup of tea, but hey, that's out there. And I'm glad that they keep making these things. I wish the design aesthetic, this tactile, this old school feel ended up in a modern optic. And so if anybody's listening from Sigma or Tokina, Tamron, any of the larger manufacturers that want to give me autofocus with something like this, shut up and take my money.
Yes. Yes.
All right.
All right.
Let's go into our final story, which I was surprised when I saw this because it seems so simple. I can't believe it hasn't been done before.
It's like a post-it note. Why didn't I think of that?
Exactly. So from Petapixel, it's Alter RFS, a hinged lens filter adapter that swings out of the way. And if you haven't seen how this works, head on over to Photo Geek Weekly to check out the show notes and take a look at this thing. Basically, you screw your filter into the front of this thing. It has a little magnetic lock so that you can put it in front of your camera normally. You shake your camera about, this thing is not going to let go. But if you want that filter to be removed from your camera, but you don't want to unscrew it, you simply lift it up like a hinge and have that sit on the top of your camera. And it's designed, it looks like you can adjust the tension on it, mm-hmm. How rigid it is. But you'd want that pretty rigid so that it doesn't bounce back and forth. And so you can basically, if you want to have a polarizing filter on your camera, but you want to bounce between polarized and not polarized, and you're constantly, take that thing out of the bag, screw it in, and then you take the picture, and then you want to unscrew it, put it back in your bag. You're not going to do that. You're always going to leave it on or leave it off. It's not going to be a very convenient switch thing. This looks unbelievably convenient. And so you took a look at this, Mike. What are your opinions?
Yeah, I'm looking at it thinking I just bought some Leica filters and maybe I should have waited a little bit longer because this looks pretty good. Now, I wonder, I didn't read all of it or see if they mentioned anything about infrared, because I know when I was shooting infrared before I converted my camera and I would have the filters on, one of the things I had to do was take the filter off, focus and everything and frame everything and then put the filter back on, because once I put it on, I couldn't see anything.
That was this, one of the use cases that immediately came to mind.
Yeah. So this would be perfect. You just flip it up, frame everything, focus everything, flip it back down, boom, you go.
Exactly. So if you have an unconverted camera that is just capturing regular light, it might let 1% of infrared light through. But in that case, you'd have to be on a tripod, you'd have to be buttoned down. And as soon as you put the filter on the front to block all visible light, but let the infrared light pass through, you can't see anything through the viewfinder, nothing at all. So this would be perfect to set it up conveniently, throw it in place, like you said, take the picture. Or, you know, if I was doing a series of how scenes will look like with a neutral density filter or not a neutral density filter, or for video work, right? That would be very helpful. If you don't have an ND filter built into your camera or your lens, then if you want to shoot a wide aperture at a slower shutter speed for smooth video purposes, then you just flip this thing down when the sun comes out or when you go outside and lift it back up when you're back indoors. From a videographer's perspective, this looks like it's very convenient as well.
Yeah, and it has some kind of gasket around the edge of it to stop light leak, because I was worried about that. You know, how tight of a seal are you going to get here? But, you know, you're attaching the part without the filter on it to the ring, I guess, of the lens. And then the part with the filter is on a hinge. So when you bring them back down together, there's magnets that hold it together. And then there's a gasket that's going to create that light leak protection. And from what I was reading, if you get the RFS Plus, I think it is maybe, where you can get maybe one that's bigger that can fit all your lenses.
So yeah, if you have, or for all of your filters rather, I typically buy all of my filters at the 77 millimeter filter thread size, because I've got lenses that are smaller than that, but that's as big as they come. So I only buy one filter for a purpose, and then I buy step-up rings that would allow me to mount that. And so they have their Plus version that has a ring on the camera side that is smaller than the filter thread side. So you can, again, balance that stuff out as you would. I bought in at the US $63 price point. And as we're talking, they have 10 left at that before it jumps up a little bit in price to $67. But I think that it's valuable at that price to have in my camera bag for filters that I might regularly use. Right now, they are within it doesn't give me a percentage here, but, and it's giving me numbers in Canadian dollars. They've raised $133,000 of $135,000 that they need, which in US is $100,000 US. So they are an inch away from their goal, making this a reality. And if the design of this thing is simple enough that I can't see there being too many manufacturing hiccups that would make this problematic to receive at the end of the day. So I backed it. And so bringing that to everybody's attention here, the Alter RFS, Rapid Filter System. And if I like it enough, I might buy more in the future.
Yeah, and I got it pulled up here too. After the show, maybe I'm doing you and this one too. Because like I said, there's six left at $63 in US. And that's not a ton of money. So if this turned out to be total junk, I haven't wasted a lot of money, but like you also said, it's a fairly simple design. That's why you kind of kick yourself, going, why haven't I seen this before? So with that simple of design, I don't know why it wouldn't work.
Well, and I say simple, but they have done some things to make sure that this is effective. Like you have a space between the filter and the objective lens, because you have to have this hinge mechanism within there, right? Well, they baffled part of that mechanism. Now, the baffling is like a ribbed or a ringed design designed to scatter and absorb light so that it doesn't bounce around and cause problems. And you can see that there's baffling inside of this adapter in order to give you the best possible quality. They've looked at the problems that could possibly arise, and they've handled that with some interesting design choices. So, awesome. Yeah, I'm a proud backer of this one. So with that said, before we get into the picks of the week, I'd like to ask you, Mike, where can people find you and your podcast and anything you'd like to plug?
Well, the best place to find us is over at jpegtoraw.com. JPEG, J-P-E-G, the number 2, raw.com. And if you want to email...
How many episodes are you up to now?
We've skipped a few more than you've skipped, but we just Tuesday, we're live on, generally on Tuesdays, we do a live video show through and do it live through YouTube. We just did 232. So, and
fantastic.
I will mention, so I've never met you in person, Don, and we've known each other now for a few years, maybe even more than a few years. I have only met two people from that are related in any way to JPEG to Raw. One was, I'm going to forget his last name, but Ali I can't remember his last name, but he's been on the show early on. I met him in Alaska last year. He's from Florida. I'm from Georgia, or live in Georgia. And we were both happened to be in Alaska at the same time in the same place for about 2 hours. And we got to meet. And then last month, for the very first time, my co-host, who's been with me for 8 years, Tim, you remember Tim?
Yeah.
I met Tim in person as he was down here in Atlanta. I was going out on business the next day. He came in a day early for business. And so we have a 1 day overlap and we were able to meet for the very first time. So that's awesome. Someday I hope to meet you.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to. Maybe you could make your way up here. That'd be great.
That'd be better temperature than we have here is 95 here.
Well, I'm a little bit envious of that. Hey, things are warming up quite nicely here and summer is finally in swing. The trees have leaves on them. Can you imagine? All right. Well, you can find jpeg2raw.com and you're going to say your email as well?
Just podcast@jpeg2raw.com. So really perfect. Easy.
Anybody have any questions? They can get a hold of Mike there. All right, let's get into the picks of the week. And Mike, why don't you go first?
Okay, mine, we talked about Lightroom early on, and I still am mainly a Lightroom user. I love Lightroom, but there's been a lot of press lately about some issues with Adobe that people aren't happy. And, you know, even a subscription model, lots of people from the beginning were not happy with the subscription model. I'm in it because I use a lot of Adobe products, so I'm in the full thing. But I have been using more and more from Skyloom, a product called Luminar. And I'm sure y'all have talked about it here on the show.
It's actually been recommended before recently, but I'm glad you bring it up again because it just kind of shows how many people are gravitating towards Luminar. And Skyloom also makes Aurora HDR and a bunch of other stuff. But Luminar is your pick today, right?
Luminar, and I think they're up to version 3.1 and 3.1.1 has come in before, you know, at some point. But, you know, version 3.1 is the current one. They've added digital asset management, which if you remember back, I think with Luminar 2018, they didn't have that. Now, we'll say it's not on par, in my opinion, with Lightroom yet, but they're getting closer and closer with it, each iteration to where if you are someone who's tired of the subscription model or tired of other things with Adobe, you just want to give something else a try, but you want something close to Lightroom, then Luminar is something you should look at. You can do a free 30-day trial without having to buy it. And then when you have to buy it, it's not that expensive. And it's a one-time purchase.
I would recommend, and this is kind of going on your recommendation of Luminar, that pretty much every software manufacturer out there offers you a free trial of some sort. I'm not sure exactly what the lengths are or what any strings might be attached. But take a day of your life, like half a day, whatever. Download Luminar. Download On One, download Capture One, download DxO or whatever else. I mean, there's tons of options out there. Download five or six of them and just load up a bunch of images within them and go through what your regular workflow would be for those images, the same images in each program, and figure out which is going to work the best for you. And I don't know of anybody that's actually done that, and I'm guilty. I haven't done that either, but it just seems to make a lot of sense moving forward to find out exactly what's going to work for you. You're effectively shopping around for a workflow that matches you as a person.
And we all shoot a little different. We all have our own little workflow, so that's very important. I will say this, if you're a Lightroom user, if you're dead set on Lightroom, but you're willing to look at On One or Luminar or some of the others you mentioned, go in with an open mind because the flow may be a little different than you're used to or a lot different than you're used to. But I imagine when you first used Lightroom, it was different than what you used before. For me, when I first used Lightroom, I think it had a 30-day trial. It wasn't until day 17 that I finally said, you know what? I'm starting to like this product. I think at day 16, I was thinking, I'm done. I can't get used to this. Something snapped and changed at day 17 where I started to like it. Now, not wanting you to give 17 days to one of these, but go in with an open mind and, you know, maybe some of the quirks of that program, some of the things that are different are things you can live with, and maybe there's things that you like better. And knowing I have not used On One hardly at all, and I should give that a try too, Don. But the more I use Luminar, the more used to it I get, and the more I'm getting, you know, the flow going on. There are some things that are missing that I still can't make the switch for, but I've purchased it. I'm past the trial phase. I've purchased it.
Right.
So I'm talking with my own money.
Well, and when you look at putting a lump sum down for a piece of software instead of being on the subscription model, there's always something satisfying about that as well. Luminar has a digital asset manager, so does On1 Photo Raw. In fact, it can import your Lightroom catalog now. They've added a lot of functionality to mirror what Lightroom can do so that when you import your images, they look nearly identical as to what they would have done in Adobe software in terms of raw interpreting and what have you. And that, I think, is going to be one of the keys, is that digital asset manager, because you've got this ecosystem. And in order to jump into a piece of software that can't keep you in an ecosystem, then it's always going to be something that you'll jump to a little bit, then you'll jump back. But if you want to jump in and stay in, you need to have it all managed, right?
Right. Have you completely left Lightroom? Are you totally on one then?
The only thing that I use Lightroom for now is when I need to send images as layers to Photoshop. And this is when I'm doing like extensive focus stacking, because on one we'll do up to 14 images for focus stacking. But if I'm doing more than that, then Photoshop has to be the thing for that. And I guess I could use Bridge, because Bridge can send images as layers to Photoshop as well. So Lightroom is going away, and hopefully within the next year, I'll say that, yeah, that's no longer on my machine.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, that's my pick.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate that. And I'm going to be really selfish for my pick and plug my book again, because that crowdfunding campaign, like I said, has just started. Macro Photography, The Universe at Our Feet. If you own my book or have seen it, Sky Crystals, which is a wonderful tomb of knowledge on snowflakes and how to photograph on the extreme small scale and the entire process within that. It's the same physical outer dimensions. It's just 50 pages more in terms of the content, and much more varied content, all tailored to the photographer, the nature lover, and the photo geek, really, because we get really technical in some of these aspects to overcome challenges of magnification and diffraction and what you can actually use to get closer to subjects and what you can do for composition in a really creative way and lighting and all that stuff. So if you want to kind of get inside my mind in terms of what I deal with in macro photography, the challenges that I faced, the paths that I've walked down, all of the missteps that have led to successes down the way, which I think is so much more valuable than just seeing the finished product and saying, oh yeah, these were the camera settings used to take this picture, and this is the lens that I used. That's valuable on the surface, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. And this book is that whole darn iceberg. So you can find that on Kickstarter, but you'll also find it. I'll be linking it in the show notes at photogeekweekly.com and my own website at doncom.ca. If you follow me anywhere on social media, you'll have a hard time missing the announcement as well. So your support is so sorely needed. As I mentioned, the minimum amount of money to make this a success is $30,000. And of course, Kickstarter takes 5% of that, plus between 3 and 5% for fees. So that's up to 10% less that I don't receive on that number. Plus the logistics of shipping this stuff around the world count towards that total, but not towards the production funds. So it'd be great if we can exceed that by a stronger number. Ideally, I'd like to print 5,000 copies, not 1,000. And if I can get there, I'm going to be producing videos that are tailored into every chapter of the book. If I still have funds left over, I'm going to roll that right back into the project, improve the paper quality of the book, maybe even make it a bigger footprint. So I'm doing this up to the nines, and with your help, we'll get there.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to sit here. Once we hang up, I'm just going to sit here on my computer and hit refresh, because I want to be number one.
All right. Well, we'll make sure that happens, Mike.
I have my big, now I have a normal chair that I sit in all the time. You can't believe all the work I do down here for the podcast and my photos and everything. I used to, for years, sit on a card chair, a card table chair with that hard bottom and everything.
You poor soul.
I know, but you could see the stuff behind me. I have your previous book behind me on the shelf. You can't see it now with this stupid big chair.
Well, you got to like move it onto your mixer or something.
I need to move it somewhere. This is a comfortable chair, though, so I'm not going to give up the chair.
Yes, I don't blame you one bit. All right, Mike. Well, thank you for being the guest on this episode of Photo Geek Weekly. Happy to reach number 70 with you in the co-pilot seat. And, we're both photographers. We both have so much fun with photography, with geekery. And so with all that we've said, I think it's time to get out and shoot.